It is either a complete rogue state that must be isolated by everybody, or it means that all these other countries are complicit and basically covering responsibility for themselves by issuing empty warnings.
I wanted to go to that issue of the Netherlands court ordering the Dutch government to stop exporting. These are U.S.-made F-35 jet parts being stored in the Netherlands to Israel. In the ruling, one of the judges wrote, quote, it is undeniable that there's a clear risk that the exported F-35 parts are used in serious violations of international humanitarian law. In November, Oxfam and Amnesty International sued the Dutch government, saying the arms transfers violate Netherlands' obligations under international law to prevent war crimes. Are you seeing this escalating around the world and other countries doing the same? Certainly, Germany gives even more weapons, and of course, the United States the most.
I am seeing a surge. We have seen for the past 5 months, the only thing that has kept humanity together is the surge of civil society, which has waged lawsuits, which has risen in protest to do the work that states have failed to do. We see in the United States, the Center for Constitutional Rights bring a lawsuit in the Northern District of California, where the judge agreed that the ICJ was correct, that this is undeniable, a case of genocide, but he doesn't have the jurisdiction in order to stop the Biden administration. We saw the highest court in the world say the same thing, that this is plausibly genocide. We are seeing a series of judicial decisions that are coming to the same conclusion, but none of them can be enforced without political will, which is being impeded in the Security Council by the United States. Let's be clear. The ICJ on January 26, when it issued its provisional orders, said that the international community has a duty and a responsibility according to its responsibility under the Genocide Convention not to perpetuate Israel's genocidal campaign. We see Israel directly violating those provisional orders. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians have been killed since January 26. We know for a fact that they have impeded the access to humanitarian aid, going so far as the Israeli Navy shooting, lobbing at UN humanitarian convoys from the Mediterranean Sea. We also see very clearly a continuing incitement to genocide, most recently in the convening of a far-right coalition of, I think, 11 ministers in government under the banner of settlement, bring security and victory. There is an explicit campaign to depopulate the Gaza Strip, to resettle it. No one is mincing words. Everybody is watching, covering themselves with these empty promises and warnings as Israel continues with its campaign. And this is a warning to the world. This is a warning to the world that we are watching, that this is very blatant and being exposed. In this situation that we have right now, in the worst case scenario, Israel will continue with its campaign. Egypt, which is trying to prevent this from happening, will likely create a buffer zone in the Sinai. If Israel is actually successful in pushing out the Palestinians, they will be stuck in that buffer zone, as have refugees from Syria been stuck at the buffer zone with Jordan and Iraq. That is the worst case scenario. Israel or Netanyahu telling the world that they're going to evacuate the Palestinians up north mean nothing when the north has been decimated. Rafah is the last standing city. They should not be taken. There's nowhere to go north. Israel must stop its genocidal campaign now. If it wants to offer refuge to Palestinians, it must offer refuge to Palestinians within what is historic Palestine, Palestine 1948, where they can actually be housed safely and where we know Israel does not want them and will return them to Gaza. There are many options at our disposal, and yet none of them are being accessed in this moment.
I want to ask you your thoughts on this latest development, the overnight airstrikes in Rafah, coming as Israeli forces carried out an operation to free two Israeli-Argentine hostages who were found to be in good condition, Fernando Simon Marman, age 60, and Louis Haar, age 70. Earlier today, a relative of the two Israeli hostages freed in Rafah called for Israel to reach a deal now.
And we know about the discussions in Cairo or in Paris and others between the Hamas, between Israeli, with the mediators. please be serious and strike a deal. The Israeli people needs the deal done. Not yesterday, not tomorrow, today. We want it done as soon as possible in order for to give us some breathe. We must breathe a little bit.
Now, yeah. This is very interesting because this is a man whose beloved ones have been held since October 7th. But he's saying we cannot rest unless all the hostages are freed. And he's calling for a truce. But that is not what Netanyahu is calling for. Are you concerned that finding these hostages in an apartment building in Rafah will lead to more bombing and attacks in Rafah or to justify a full-scale assault?
Amy, Israel is not concerned. The Israeli government is not concerned with its hostages. If they were, they would have engaged in good faith negotiations. The diplomatic negotiations led to the relief of 136 hostages. That wasn't any military operations. After 5 months, they've only extracted 2 hostages. We know that the families want a truce. We know that the government is opposing a truce. We know that the concern is not the hostages. Israel shot to kill 2 of them, 2 of their own, who were raising white flags and speaking in Hebrew, giving us an idea that this is not a legitimate war. This is a genocidal campaign of extermination. Last night, the images that came out of Rafah are horrifying. There was a young girl, her legs cut off, hanging off of a wire by her shirt. This is disproportionate, excessive force that is meant to terrorize a population that is telling them, you have no life here. There is no future here. You must leave. That is the message that is being sent. We're seeing young children who are forced to be far older than their age. A young boy who escaped bombing, having his head and the blood cleaned off of it, telling the world, "No bakhafish, I am not scared." How can he not be scared in this situation? How are all of us not terrified? We have taken away life for these children. We are decimating their future, even if we do survive. Images of babies who are being removed from the rubble with only 2 limbs, with no family members left. What is their future? And yet we're obscuring these atrocities. We're obscuring these genocidal campaigns with words of distraction. We're taking it and abstracting it to warfare and strategy, hostages and the negotiations. When the humanitarian situation speaks for itself, when tribunals have told us repeatedly, this is a genocide. It must be ended unequivocally. And that is incumbent upon us now before we see the last city in Gaza, the one that is normally home to 220,000 Palestinians, now housing 1.5 million Palestinians, 80% of the population, in tents and in dire humanitarian situation. We should be rushing in to treat them with medicine, with food, with water, with adequate care, rather than now preparing massacres for them, like the speaker before you, Dua, who has created a GoFundMe to save herself and her children. This is our responsibility. Last word on this. There is a concept in international law known as state responsibility, where a state must deal with the action, the consequences of its actions. Israel cannot say that it is now fighting a war of self-defense, which it doesn't have a right to under international law, against territory that it occupies. But if those actions are illegal, it must bear the consequences for them. Israel has imposed a siege against international law for 17 years, imposed a prolonged military occupation for 56 years, imposed an apartheid regime, which is a crime against humanity, that the international community has said is an apartheid regime, and still asking the world for an exception and blaming the Palestinians as the assailants as it is committing a genocide, and now asking the world to let it commit genocide as a form of exception, that somehow it is like any other situation. And rather than meet that with the full force of diplomatic and international will to rebuff it, instead, we're allowing Israel to create that exception, which will make none of the world safe, when other powerful countries and nuclear powers decide that they want to decimate inconvenient population, a native population, as in this case, in order to fulfill its national interests. It defies all of the logic of international legal institutions and international law, which are set up to regulate things like this in this very moment.
We just have 10 seconds, but you have a top aide to President Biden admitting that the Biden administration has made many missteps since the beginning of this. What do you think they could do, a single action that could make the greatest difference when it comes to what Israel does in Gaza, Noura Erekat?
They can abstain in the Security Council and allow an immediate ceasefire to take place. Biden can pick up the phone and tell Netanyahu to stop. They can actually stop the weapons transfers or even revoke this supplemental budget, which plans to resettle Palestinians in what will be an ethnic cleansing campaign and complicity in genocide. There are so many things to be done. These are empty words aimed at the 2024 elections as opposed to aimed at compliance with international law to meet our duty and responsibility under the Genocide Convention.
Noura Erekat, we want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian human rights attorney, associate professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law on the Question of Palestine. When we come back, Bishop William Barber on plan to have the Poor People's Campaign march on 30 state legislatures to catalyze the voting power of poor and low-wage workers ahead of November's elections. Stay with us. Covered by Nikki Thomas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the 2024 election heats up, the Poor People's Campaign announced this month the plans to catalyze the voting power of poor and low-wage workers across the United States. As part of a 40-week operation, thousands of volunteers are working to mobilize 15 million voters, with the first major coordinated actions taking place outside 30 state houses on March 2nd, 3 days before Super Tuesday. The voting bloc, described as the sleeping giant, could potentially determine the outcome of the elections. Activists say nearly half of U.S. voters are living in poverty or low-wage households. This is Alabama activist Linda Burns, a former Amazon worker, speaking at a news conference with the Poor People's Campaign last week.
$180 a week. $180 a week. Amazon let me go because I was helping organize the union. We didn't get the union in Alabama, but I'm going to do everything in my power. I'm going to stand in solidarity.
We're joined right now in Durham, North Carolina, by Bishop William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Here in New York, we're joined by Michael Zweig, founding director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life, professor emeritus of economics at State University of New York, Stony Brook, where he received the SUNY Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching. His new book is called Class, Race, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Bishop Barber wrote the book's introduction. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Bishop Barber, this is an enormous undertaking. As the talking heads and the corporate media networks talk about the strength of the economy and how it's only getting better, talk about what you're seeing on the ground and how people are organizing.
Well, Amy and Michael, we have to have an enormous undertaking. because we have an enormous economic and moral problem. In 2019, before COVID, we had 140 million poor and low-wage, low-wealth brothers and sisters in this country, 43% of the adult population. Going into COVID, coming out of COVID, we now have 135 million. It went down some to about 112 million, then it went back up. It went down because of investments that were made during COVID, but they were not continued. And poverty right now is the fourth leading cause of death. Over 800 people are dying every day from poverty and low wages. On the ground, people are hurting. People who make less than $15 an hour, we have not had a pay raise, Amy, since 2009. There are 52 million people who make less than a living wage of $15 an hour. We had 58 senators during COVID to vote no on raising the wages of essential workers. We've had, even during COVID, we still have 87 million people who are uninsured or underinsured. And so we know now there is not a state in this country where if 30%, 20 to 30% of poor and low-wage workers who are eligible to vote that have been infrequent would vote that they could not change the outcome of the election. In some states, Amy, you have a situation where you have almost a million poor low-wage voters who did not vote in the last two elections, and the election was only won at large by 10,000 votes or 40,000 votes or 100,000 votes. Poor and low-wage people are saying, we must move this power. So March the 2nd, we're having a launching. It's not just a March, a launching of a 42-week campaign to mobilize 15 million poor and low-wage voters. We're going to raise up people in every state that will be trained in every form of voter mobilization, from technology to the old way of just getting and walking on the turf and knocking on doors, to touch these voters, because right now the democracy could literally be changed and saved by the power of poor, low-wage workers. But it's not just holding on to the democracy. We're saying, what kind of democracy do you want? We want one with living wages. We want on the ends. Poverty is the fourth leading cause of death. We want full funding of public education. We want women's rights. We want to stop the proliferation of guns. We are uniting around those things. And why state houses, Amy? Because state houses are where the political insurrections are taking place. Everything that we have on our flyer for March 2nd, you can either stop or start in a state house. We're challenging both sides of the aisle. And then on June 15th, we're coming to challenge the Congress to launch the summer initiative of this massive mobilization on June 15th. But we must have a massive movement because we have a massive moral and economic problem.
I want to bring Michael Zweig into this conversation. You're on the New York State Coordinating Committee of the Poor People's Campaign, and you've written this book, Class, Race, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Can you talk about the fact that, well, Columbia University found only 46% of voters with household incomes less than twice the federal poverty rate cast a vote in 2016, as compared to 68% turnout rate for voters who had a household income more than twice the poverty line. This leads politicians to ignore whole swaths of people and what you think then needs to be done and how the Poor People's Campaign is addressing this, Michael.
Well, my book, thank you, Amy, for having me here today, and Bishop Barber, good to be with you. The task, I think, is to understand, first of all, why it is and that we have these outrages that cause poverty and that cause the women of this country to lose their agency and lose their right to health care, that threaten the environment, all of these issues that are brought together and that have a special effect on poor and low-wage workers. These are not just things that just happen or fall out of the sky. They come from the functioning of a capitalist system, and in particular, the capitalist system in the United States, a sort of capitalism with U.S. characteristics. I think that we need to, as we build our movements, build them with an understanding of what it is that we're dealing with and what we have to confront in order to address the inequalities, in order to address the injustices that the Poor People's Campaign is organized to do, is to bring together what Bishop Barber has often called a fusion movement that isn't just one piece of the puzzle, but all of those things brought together. And I think that this book, Class, Race, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism, is a resource to try to get that understanding and to bring it forward so that we can all be marching together, no matter what our particular movement or particular concern is, that we all echo each other, we all come together in one mighty force. And that is both a political question of mobilization, but it's also an intellectual question, a question of analysis and political education. And what this book is trying to do is to be a resource for all of that organizing and mobilizing that's going on.
We just heard a low-wage worker, an Amazon worker, talking about why it's so important to organize, Michael Zweig. In what ways can the labor movement leverage collective bargaining and advocacy efforts against corporate entities like Amazon? Also talk about the significance of the United Auto Workers and what they did in their strike that led to so much advancement?
The UAW strike, the auto worker strike under the leadership of Sean Fain, was really a watershed moment, I think, in the current labor scene and the current political climate in the country. And I say that because it was, for the first time, a strike that attacked all three major U.S. automakers simultaneously, and it struck each one selectively. And it did that in a way which also brought a public message that the corporate leadership is getting 40% wage increases, 50% wage increases. They're making millions of dollars a year, and the auto workers are not getting any piece of that. And so the task there was to bring forward those demands in a context that made sense to the American people, and of course to the auto workers themselves. And I think that what was also important is that Sean Fain addressed the question as a class question. He talked about his workers as working class people. When President Biden went to the Warren, Michigan picket line, he talked about the workers are in the middle class, and the union makes the middle class. No, the union makes working people have a better life, and they're still working class people. And Sean Fain understands that, and also understands in the history of the UAW that, and other parts of the labor movement, that the labor movement, the unions, have an obligation to talk about the whole structure of society, to go to the root and go to the core of why it is that they have to fight every day for a better wage and for better working conditions, why it's unacceptable to have workers paid so low that they have to get food stamps, that they have to get public assistance in order to make ends meet, and the corporations can go ahead and make billions and billions of dollars. What Sean Fain and what the rest of the labor movement is coming, I think, to understand is that it's important to take on the whole range of questions that affect working people, not just at the workplace, but also in their communities. So that means hunger issues, that means issues of women's equality, that means racial justice, that means the environment. All those questions are questions for working people to address, and to address in conjunction with those other movements that are outside the labor movement per se, just as those other movements need to pay attention to and take strength from what the labor movement is doing. And that kind of fusion movement, which the Poor People's Campaign is about, is what I'm trying to get across also in this book.
Bishop Barber.
Amy.
Yes.
May I? Yeah. We also don't have to stop using the language working class. Poor. See, part of our own struggle inside of the movement, and I say to Michael and others, we can't back up on the language poor, because it's not used. The poor working class, because we don't use that language. We fall back into a trap of capitalism by saying work. We're saying poor and low-wage workers. We're saying workers that are every day hustle and hard and still live poor and low wage. You know, one third of all poor folk live in the South. One of the movements that actually helped to get to UAW was when we challenged Smithfield in the South, in North Carolina, and won, brought poor, low wage, black, white, Latinos together in a small, small Tatawia, North Carolina. Nobody ever heard about it. And they said we couldn't win. We have to go to these states because what we say, for instance, in the South, we say those are red states, but we don't know what color those states are because we've not really mobilized. One third of all poor people live in the South. There's not a state in the South where if you mobilize 25% of poor and low-wage workers, that it would not change the outcome. In Florida, the percentage is under 3% of those infrequent voters. In North Carolina, it's under 19%. In Georgia, it's under 7%. All over the South and all over the country. In Wisconsin, it's less than 1%. So we, even in our language, and we have to say poor and low-wage workers, there's not a state in this country we call battleground state where the margin of victory was within 3% for the presidential election, that poor and low-wage workers don't make up 40% of the electorate. There's not a state in this country where poor and low-wage workers don't make up over 30% of the electorate. This is not also about the system, but it is also about poor and low-wage people grabbing their power and understanding the power that we have not used. Remember, it was Dr. King in 1965 at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March who said the greatest fear of the racist aristocracy in this country would be for the masses of Negroes and the masses of poor white working folk to come together and form a voting bloc that could fundamentally deal with the economic architecture of this country. You know, I've just released a book called White Poverty, and it's looking through the lies and the mythology pushed down by the Southern strategy to literally divide poor and low-wage black and white people as a way of continuing to exacerbate the divisions of race and class. This is a power move for poor and low-wage folk, poor and low-wage folk, religious leaders and allies. And lastly, one of the things Sean did with UAW is he made it a moral issue. He lifted it up and said, this is not, it's a class issue, it's an issue about work, but it's a moral issue. And when he framed it that way, it actually helped more people to grab on what he was saying.
Bishop Barber, before we go, I wanted to turn to a different issue. We just have a minute, and I wanted to ask you about the moral case for a ceasefire that you've written about in Gaza. In November, you joined a group of Christian leaders for a vigil outside the White House demanding President Biden support a ceasefire in Gaza and said, quote, we must join forces with Jews and Christians and Muslims around the world who are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and the safe return of all hostages and civilian prisoners and to stop the killing. Your final thoughts on this as Israel weighs a full-scale invasion of Rafah?
We should, all moral leaders, needed to say no to what Hamas did to children and women, and no, no, no to what Israel, the Israeli government, and Netanyahu is now continuing to do. In the original argument I wrote about Hamas, I also challenged the apartheid state that the Netanyahu regime had in Israel. We said we must speak as one voice, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, to say the indiscriminate killing of women and children in this war is immoral. And let me give you a scripture straight from the text that Muslims, Jews, and Christians all agree on. It's Isaiah 10. It ought to be a framework for how we move forward. Woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights and make women and children prey, P-R-E-Y. That is a moral text from the ancient Hebrew scriptures that Muslims and Christians all agree on. And it is a prophetic challenge to governments. And that must be our prophetic challenge to what Netanyahu and them are doing today.
Bishop William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, speaking to us from Durham, North Carolina. And Michael Zweig, economist and author of Class, Race, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Bishop Barber wrote the introduction. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes. Happy birthday, Messiah. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.